finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.
Cricket mostly is about spotlight and who can grab it on a particular day. On the one hand, you have Mayank Agarwal, who has been scoring runs like nobody's business, but cannot get enough headlines because sometimes it is Rohit Sharma and at other times it is Virat Kohli. Of course, Kohli is used to headlines, but in a comprehensive innings and 137-run win for India, there was someone else who caught the eye. Someone who is perhaps not talked about as much or celebrated as much. But we will get to that in just a bit. Hello to the brand new episode of Hotspot. I am Chetan Narula, journalist and broadcaster who's a bit under the weather. So I apologize in advance if I sneeze in between talking cricket. And along with me, my co-host, as always, former India cricketer and now broadcaster, Deep Das Gupta. What have you got for us on the show today, Deep?
Chetan, hello everyone, and hopefully you guys have been liking our show here at Hotspot. Well, what we have in this episode is we'll be taking a brief look at what went right for India, what went wrong for South Africa. India's reign as number one continues, full points, and of course, 11th home series win, which is a record in itself.
Absolutely, what an impressive record. And, at the top of the show, we talked about a not so much talked about topic or someone, you know, in a group, right, Deep?
Absolutely. And, it's a thankless job, something that I've been on the receiving end more often than not. Yes, we will talk about Ridhiman Saha and how important he is in terms of wicket-keeping skills today, especially when the focus is on batsman-keeper more than a keeper batsman.
And continuing with this theme of talking about people who are not talked about, we have a very special guest, someone who represents the backbone of Indian cricket, the average Indian cricket fan. So let's dive straight ahead into this show. So let's talk about the second test match. As Deep Das Gupta said, that, you know, it was the 11th series win for India, 2-0 series lead and innings and 137 runs. So many numbers again to throw up at you. 108 for Mayank Agarwal, 254 for Virat Kohli. No surprises there. Ravindra Jadeja, 91, 601 for 5 for India. And after you get 600 deep on Indian pitches, you know, you can just let your bowlers rip, and especially this Indian bowling attack, which can take 20 wickets on any sort of wicket, really.
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest takeaway for as far as Indian cricket is concerned. The last year and a half, the Indian bowling, and honestly speaking, I think it's the best bowling attack in the world, most rounded bowling attack in the world. And on top of that, especially when you're playing in the subcontinent, if you win the toss, that makes it that easier. But having said that, this pitch was different, Chetan. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I believe this comprehensive victory was more of a statement made by the Indian team on a surface which had grass, which had carry. India won the toss, batted first, and actually did very well. I think in the first day, first session, lost only one wicket, scored 77 odd runs in that first session, where the ball did quite a bit as far as seam bowlers are concerned. Both Philander, Rabada, they were really good in the first spells. But I thought India did really well, and that too on the second day as well. I mean, the first session with the second new ball, India lost just one wicket. So I think predominantly India did make a statement here saying, you know what, as a batting unit also, we are much improved. But as far as bowling is concerned, we are right up there. And we really don't depend that much on conditions. Because if you look at day three, day four, where India picked up 3 and 4 wickets respectively as compared to a wicket apiece in the first couple of days by South African bowlers.
Absolutely. I think there was a difference in approach in the bowling attacks, and it was a bit surprising because you look at South Africa and they were playing an extra pacer, Unric Nothia, who's obviously the debutant in this test match. But again, 7 wickets for the Indian bowlers, and that's spin and pace, primarily pace. Umesh Yadav coming in, swinging the ball. Ishant Sharma was effective. Mohammad Shami, wow. You know, getting the ball to bounce. When was the last time we saw a pacer banging the ball in on an Indian surface and getting that sort of bounce? And Ridhiman Saha had to collect the ball, dive all the way, and he was up to the task. More about him in just a bit. But again, the approach in bowling, of course, we know India are heavy in terms of spinners, but South African pacers were totally outbowled. Deep, tell me, when the Indian team travels abroad, there's always this thing about adapting to the Kookaburra ball, adapting to the Duke's ball. How easy or tough is it to adapt to the SG ball when, say, South Africa come and play here?
I think it would be comparatively easy because it's a bowler-friendly ball, because it's much harder, the seam is more pronounced and proud, and it stays that way for longer. So I think it's a bowler-friendly ball as compared to, let's say, a Kookaburra. So that's where I think bowlers need to make a little more adjustments, because, again, Kuka is a lot softer and the seam goes away in the first, 20, 30 overs.
Yeah.
So it's predominantly the batsmen who need to make more adjustments when you're talking about a SG ball or a Duke's ball here. So from that perspective, I was a little surprised also the kind of spell. I mean, obviously, they bowled well in the first session, day one, Rabada and Philander. Credit to the Indian openers, including Rohit, who did pretty well to kind of see through the first half an hour, 45 minutes. But I thought they bowled a little short, because the biggest challenge more than the ball, as far as overseas teams coming to India is concerned, is the length. Because of the slowness of the pitch or whatever, I mean, you've got to kind of adjust the length, and that is the key. I mean, same with Indian bowlers when they go abroad. And I just got a feeling that looking at that pitch and bounce, maybe the South African bowlers got a little carried away, saying, listen, you know what, this is very rare. We don't get to see pitches like this in the subcontinent and especially in India. So maybe just got a little more excited and carried away.
Absolutely. I think somebody like he was bowling quite short, and, you know, it was a bit of inexperience. And in that sense, I thought South Africa, in a way, are caught between a rock and a hard place, because in the first test, they picked three spinners. That didn't work. So they again went back and picked three pacers this time. I thought Lungi Ngiri would have been a better pick, but I'm sure there were doubts about his fitness. There's always that cloud over his fitness. I was surprised that they decided to go in with a debutant. Not that Ngiri is very experienced in that sense, but again, like I said, you pick a debutant who hasn't really bowled too much with the SG ball, who's struggling, of course, with his line and length, and you look at his figures. 25 overs went for 100 runs, 4 and over. That's your third pacer, which was almost like you should have played Dan Peed.
That was decided because of the fact that he was in India. He's been in India for a while playing for South Africa A. Yeah,
probably.
So he did all right during that one day series against India, where he did pick up a few wickets and he was impressive there, and he got some idea as far as bowling on Indian surfaces with an SG test as well, even though white ball cricket in India is also played with a Kuka. But I'm sure he must have bowled with in the nets an SG red ball. So maybe that being one of the reasons. The other thing is obviously the extra pace that he has as compared to Lungi Ngidi, who is pretty quick himself. But you know what? Credit to the Indian fast bowlers. Yes, we keep talking about someone like Bumrah, who's not available at this point in time. But someone like Shami, Umesh Yadav, and obviously Ishant Sharma in the last few years, they've been absolutely phenomenal. The length, the line. I think that's a very, very... And look at the first innings, South African first innings. They were 56 for 6, if I'm not wrong. And all 6 wickets on day 3, right? End of day 2 and day 3. Yeah. Went to the Indian fast bowlers. So that tells a lot about the capability of the Indian fast bowlers. It was a much better surface to bat on day 2 end and day 3. But even then, and we're talking about South African batters here, and I saw the South African batters being uncomfortable with the bounce as far as Indian bowlers are concerned, and the bounce that they got, the movement that they got off that surface. And that is very, very heartening to see. You know, we've over the years, we've seen Indian batsmen struggle against pace and bounce when we go overseas. But you know, kind of giving a taste of their own medicine back here in India was very, very good to see.
And of course, it brings out a very different approach when you play and you have that sort of top order who started to get runs or is maybe even comfortable at the crease. Two different approaches here. One, of course, is Virat Kohli gets 250 odd runs alone. we have a very special episode planned on Virat Kohli, so we're not going to dive too deep in here about his 250. The only talking point for me, perhaps, here, Deep. Get to 250, not out. That 300 run mark was just on the horizon. India obviously had time. There are not many opportunities that come around to score a 300. Was that a mistake? You know, obviously he's the captain. I thought it was a very, very great call. You don't really see that, or you haven't really seen that too often in Indian cricket.
True. You know what I really like about Virat as a captain and as a leader, leave the captaincy aside, is that he's trying to change few things around Indian cricket and in society as well. I mean, obviously he's changed a lot. He's contributed a lot in the country being little more fitness concerned and fitness driven. Yeah. That's one of his contribution already. The other important thing is not being too number crazy and number obsessed, because like you mentioned, he could have very easily batted right through the second day and would have actually got his 300 in those 2 days itself. He wouldn't have to bat, maybe wouldn't have to bat on day three. But the fact that he didn't also tells you that, you know, we need to move on. We are so obsessed as a nation as far as numbers are concerned. We keep talking about numbers, but that doesn't really matter. Well, for us, it does. I mean, from a very early age, you know, you ask your kids, okay, how much did you get? You know, exams and all that. And we're so obsessed. It's not about learning.
Sharma,
it's not about...
Exactly.
So,
and you know what? I shouldn't be saying that because there's so much going on between Rohit Sharma fans and Virat Kohli fans. I'm not going to talk about the other aspect, but there's so much going on. Even on Twitter, there's such a war going on. But
I mean, that's what I believe, Chetan. And I think we seriously need to look beyond numbers. And numbers, yes, it's important to look at numbers, but at times, more often than not, to be honest, we look at numbers without context. You know, someone like the biggest example, you know, we're talking about Gundappa Vishwanath. He's got 1400s, right? Which is very good, but we really don't talk about him as much as maybe we should, because we only look at 1400s. But the fact of the matter is, India has never, ever lost a test match where Gundappa Vishwanath has got runs. Now you're putting those 1400s in the right context. You know what I'm saying? So just numbers, and that's something that I really, really want to kind of harp upon. As in, you know, let's not get carried away with numbers, because we are, let's face it, a nation or a society obsessed with numbers.
Yes, whether it's the Lok Sabha elections, who's getting 300 seats, who's getting 400 seats, or cricket, where who's getting triple hundreds, who's getting hundreds, or in fact, who's getting 194 when the declaration comes in Multan.
True.
You never forget that.
True. Yes.
I think the one number that I heard and read a lot about it, the one number that does obviously come to mind, and we're going to talk about it very, very quickly because the result is done and dusted, 600 on the board. Faf du Plessis brushed on it, 600 runs. What does it do to the psyche of a batting side?
Oh.
South Africa looked flushed. I mean, you've been in the field for 2 days. In Vizag, at least, it rained for a session. In Pune, it was raining after the day's play. You know, every day, 6 p.m., the heavens would open up and cause a traffic jam towards the city. But, you know, no respite from the rain here. South Africa in the field for almost six sessions. Last half an hour, they were made to bat. 3 wickets down again. What does it do to the psyche of a batting lineup? Like I said, Faf also mentioned it, 600 runs, South Africa were never in the game after that.
Absolutely. I mean, psychologically, you're gone. You know, the first thing that you think about is, okay, we'll have to get minimum 400 runs to save follow on. And to be very honest, I mean, when you travel as a team, the biggest challenge is getting over the conditions mentally. It's not the physical thing. Yes, we know how to bat. We know how to bowl. Yes, we know where to bowl or where how to bat against pace, spin or whatever it is. But it's the mental side of things where you have to be switched on every session. You know, I'll for our viewers here, and I don't know whether Chetan, we've ever spoken about this. I remember when we went to Australia way back in 2003, that historic series. We actually were counting back the number of sessions. So we weren't looking at test matches. You know what? We've got five test matches. We weren't looking at five test matches. We weren't looking at day one, day two of test match number, blah, blah, blah. But we were looking at sessions. So every session goes and you were like, okay, tick. So we did well. Next session. And that becomes very important, because when you start looking at, you know what, oh my God, three test matches, four test matches, 5 days to go, you know, conditions aren't favorable and it's kind of alien to you. You tend to kind of get bogged down, lose your focus. And that's what it seems to me is happening with South Africa.
It's also about dependence. I mean, you look at Faf du Plessis, he was batting at number five in the first innings, coming up at number four. You know, it's really gone. And, you know, he didn't even bat at number five. He batted at number six, really, because they sent in the night watchman after they were two down. And it was really surprising, or, you know, to see the way it had progressed for South Africa.
And I don't know, Chetan. Yeah. I mean, you were there at the field. You saw the body language and all.
It was down. It was down.
It was down. It was terrible. But also the fact that I don't know whether there is this cohesiveness that you need in that unit. I might be, maybe overanalyzing this, but I somehow have a feeling that it is not as cohesive a team as it should be, especially when you're traveling abroad, especially on very, very difficult conditions that would be for South Africa when they're traveling to India. I don't know. I just have a feeling that there are a lot of underlying currents that I feel.
Well, a lot of talking points coming up from this India-South Africa series, and we will brush up on them after the series is done and dusted. We'll go deeper into what ails South African cricket at the moment and what could possibly be the remedies. Right now, it's time for our second segment of this episode, where, like we mentioned, the main theme not talked about. Let's not give too much time away, Deep, now, and not talk about our main theme. Right, moving on to the second part of the show and the main theme of this episode. He's a wiry character, not the most talkative, even if behind the stumps. And he has a confident presence. He can dive and pull off some stunning catches, that one-handed catch to his left in Pune. I'll remember that for a long, long time. Well, that's his primary job, at least in India, when Ashwin and Jadeja turn the ball, Shami, Umesh, Bumrah, Ishant make it bounce high. We're talking about Ridhiman Saha, best wicketkeeper in India, and of course, in the world, in my friend Deep Das Gupta's opinion.
Absolutely. There's no two ways about it. I don't think there's a better wicketkeeper, more rounded, more accomplished wicketkeeper than Ridhiman Saha in the world right now. Be it his fitness, he's 34, but he's extremely fit. Yes, I mean, a lot of it is natural, right? He comes from Siliguri, which is high altitude. So that fitness things comes naturally to him. He's wiry, but he's also worked very, very hard on his fitness. And most importantly, as a wicketkeeper, he's technically so sound. I've been seeing him for like what? I remember I was captain of Bengal when he was first picked. Bengal had won the National Under 22 Championship, and he was a member there. And somebody said, you know, you got to look at him. And I was captain. I said, yeah. And I spoke to the selectors. I like let him be part of the squad. So he was made part of the squad. He was quiet then as well. But you know what?
You know, I'll just interject, because you just mentioned the under 22, because I just pulled up Ridhiman Saha's profile, and the line that catches my eye here is, Saha took the place of veteran keeper Deep Das Gupta and debuted in the 2007 season. Just tell me about how it happened. You were obviously the captain, Bengal captain.
Right.
How does it happen? Because obviously you're...
I'm sure you're looking at the Wikipedia page, is it? Because most of it is wrong.
Actually, actually, it's on ClickBuzz.
Okay, I need to speak to them.
You need to the ClickBuzz guys. Yeah, you need to speak to the ClickBuzz guys.
So I tell you what happened. I became a rebel. So 2005, 6, and 6, 7 season, I was the captain. He was drafted into the squad. But he played when obviously I became a rebel and I wasn't allowed to play for Bengal. So Riddhiman came in. Then I came back in 2009. And I told the selectors, listen, I just want to play as a batsman. I don't want to keep wickets because I knew it. By 2009-10, he was a better keeper than me. I mean, there was no two ways about it. 2009-10, when I came back from that, I knew he was better. I said, listen, I don't want to stop a youngster. I was then 32, 33. I think I'm not going to stop anyone's career here. I'll play as a batsman. Let him keep wickets because at that point in time, I knew it. And I actually told him, you know, start batting up the order. Yeah. You know, so I kind of told him, and he started opening the innings at that season, 2009-10. He opened in a few innings. He went at number four in a few innings because, you know, unfortunately, in our country, keepers will only come to notice when they start scoring runs.
Which brings me to, I'll interject here because it brings me to a very, very important point because Saha obviously coming back, I mean, he made his test debut. You're looking at his test debut in 2010, that was against South Africa, and it was
as a batsman,
and it was you know at that time you had Mahendra Singh Dhoni who was really into the side, so he played just as a batsman. So it was you don't often see that, Dee, but let me go back to your time once again, not drawing any parallels, not trying to say Wikipedia is right or wrong, but during your time as well, there was this premium on wicketkeepers scoring runs, wicketkeeper's primary job being batsman. I remember you started out in the middle order, then you were promoted up the order, then there was Rahul Dravid who was made to keep wickets in the ODI arena. You know, we talked about in the first segment of the show, we talked about this fascination with numbers. There's a fascination with numbers of wicketkeepers, and that's not to do with their stumpings or their catches, it's about their batting averages. Why is it so?
Absolutely, and it's predominantly because of, I guess, people like Adam Gilchrist coming in and doing what he did for Australia. At that same point in time, you had Boucher who did very well for South Africa. So everywhere you looked, you saw wicketkeeper coming at number six and making a huge difference as far as batting is concerned. The other important thing, okay, let's look at how would wicketkeepers come into prominence is only when they scored runs. When you start looking, you're reading the newspaper and you see, you're looking at Ranji Trophy numbers, you're like, okay, this guy's got 100, this guy's got double 100, right? Yes. Or this guy's got 5 wickets. Very, very rare. I honestly don't remember a wicketkeeper getting a mention in the newspaper because of his keeping, especially I'm talking about first class level. So as a wicketkeeper, if you want to be known, you will come into prominence when you start scoring runs. So invariably, as a keeper, you're thinking, you know what? Yes, I need to be a good keeper, but I have to focus more on my batting and make sure that I keep scoring runs.
Which is weird because even right now, Indian cricket in terms of wicket keeping, and I'm talking about the white ball arena, it's a bit of a flux, isn't it? You're talking about MS Dhoni who's gone out or maybe going out. We don't know what's the situation with him. But now we are starting to talk about wicketkeepers and we are not looking at who's the best wicketkeeper available. We're looking at who can score runs.
See, I can understand that concept or that school of thought as far as white ball cricket is concerned. Yes. But with red ball cricket, I would really look at a wicketkeeper batsman than a batsman wicketkeeper. Yes, I mean, wicketkeepers are still very, very important, but I think you have enough decently good wicketkeepers who can do that job, batsman wicketkeepers, right?
Right.
But when it comes to red ball cricket, and especially in the subcontinent, because again, comparatively, keeping to fast bowlers are easier than keeping to spinners of someone like Jadeja or Ashwin's caliber. On turners, on rank turners with that kind of turn and bounce to handle them, it's not easy at all. That's where you need a wicketkeeper batsman. And that's where I'm so, so happy that the Indian team management chose Riddhiman Saha over someone like a Rishabh Pant or the other options that were available or that are available because he's a better wicketkeeper. Now, that sends a signal to everyone playing first-class cricket that, you know what, this team management is changing things around. They're looking at a proper wicket keeper to play in test matches. Yeah. Who's your number one wicket keeper in the country, not necessarily the number one package as a wicket keeper batsman.
Well, I don't want this discussion to meander towards Rishabh Pant or Sanju Samson or anybody who could be in the pipeline to come up as the wicket keeper. And I mentioned Samson because he struck a double hundred. Not been a great week if you're a Rishabh Pant fan or Rishabh Pant himself. But again, not taking a pot shot or not, you know, meandering this discussion towards him. My question here is, Deep, you know, you have at some point in the next 2 years or 2 to 3 years, you have England and Australia and New Zealand. These sides are going to come in. You have a 5 test match series, 4 test match series. During these test matches and on pitches which will support spin, again, the importance of a keeper who is just a keeper becomes so much more vital. And you talk about this team management. It's not just today that they have been impressed with Saha, because I remember the 2017 tour of Sri Lanka. Oh. That is where they were actually, oh, Saha, yes, he's the best wicketkeeper. I remember talking to Ravi Shastri in Colombo, interviewing him in 17. And even then, he was singing praises of Ridhiman Saha. And I remember the Colombo test match, the SSC, where Rahane got 100 and somebody else also got 100.
I'll just add quickly, Chetan. He did not give even one bye in that whole test match.
Yeah, on a ranked earner. That test match, you don't remember for how many wickets Ashwin Jadeja took. I don't remember who was the second centurion. I think it was Pujara with Rahane. I'm not sure. What I do remember was Saha's exceptional keeping. It was a ranked earner after Gaul. In 2015, that was a ranked turner in SSC Colombo. Saha did not give a single bye. There was this catch towards the leg side. Again, this time he took it off Shami, off pace where the ball is coming quickly. With spin, it's looping up. It was going behind him. And you won't believe, I'm trying to replicate Saha's action while talking just to remember that catch. It was brilliant. And you know what? I was sitting in the stands below the Indian team's pavilion during that test match. And Ravi Shastri was shouting for Saha. Oh, yes. Oh, Saha. Oh, yes. They absolutely love Saha's wicketkeeping.
Yeah. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Listen, I've been saying this for a while now. I think for the last few years, he's been the best wicketkeeper in the world. Period.
Well, you've said that a few times, Deep. Let's talk about a few numbers here, though. And, you know, don't want to bring in the batting factor. The number that I want to talk about is 34 years of age. He's very fit. Taking those catches, you know, it's not easy if you're not fit. How long do you see Saha continuing? You obviously know him quite well. You know, what sort of conversations you've had with Ridhiman Saha off late?
Listen, I mean, a few days ago we were talking over obviously we finished our Durga Puja, so we were wishing each other Shubh Vijay and all that. We really haven't spoken about it, but you know what? I think he's got a few years easy because he's extremely fit. And the good part is he's focused on test match cricket, right?
Yes.
So in a year, you're not going to play more than, let's say, 12, 13 test matches.
Yes.
Okay. So technically speaking, he's got those 12 test matches to focus on, and obviously the IPL. So got 60-odd days of IPL there as well. So he's got enough time to kind of focus on his fitness levels, his health, his injuries, his niggles and all that. So I think he's in a good space where he's actually not even thinking about white ball cricket. Okay, that's not happening with me. Let's not focus on that. Let's just focus on what I've got, which is red ball cricket. And I think he's in a very good space. And also the fact that, listen, I know people are not a huge fan of his batting. I can understand that because he's not the prettiest batsman. You know what I'm saying? But he's effective. And that's where I have a little bit of a problem when people say, you know what? Oh, no, he's not a good batsman. He won't be successful. God, he's averaging over 30, 35, right?
Yes.
He's got 200s. I understand the fact that he does not look as impressive with his technique and everything. But give him an opportunity. Let him fail outside the country. Right. So that's where it's going to be very, very interesting is what would the team management be thinking when India starts traveling outside the subcontinent?
Well, that's a question that we will be very, very interested in finding the answer to. I mean, because, again, I don't want to steer the discussion in that direction, but Rishabh Pant, well, he's been given some time off. But remember, he has a good batting record, a good catching record as well. England,
yes, and quickly, can I add, Chetan?
But yeah,
I still believe he's future. He's definitely future, India's future, and this break will be good for him. And this break could be a blessing in disguise, and should be if he takes it in the right spirit.
Well, he's trying to replace MS Dhoni, and probably will try to replace MS Vridhiman Saha one day in the test side as well. But for the moment, if you really have to learn your wicket-keeping skills, if not as much as your batting skills, I can see nobody better than Vridhiman Saha to learn from.
Can I plug in my YouTube channel as well? Because I'm going to come up with a video real soon.
Absolutely. Some wicket-keeping masterclass on the point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, quickly, we'll move on to the third and final segment of this episode. Again, we have somebody who's not talked about too much, the average Indian cricket fan. Mm. The third and final segment of our show today deals with the other not much talked about hero of Indian cricket, and that is the average fan, the one who's walking on the road, listening to the transistor, listening to the commentary, stopping at every electronic shop and peeking what the television sets are showing the score to be. Somebody who loves cricket, who will do anything to watch the game. They'll bunk classes, they'll skip offices, they'll call in late, they'll get up at 5 a.m., they'll cry themselves hoarse at a game. They'll cry to sleep. They'll laugh to sleep. Their lives are totally dependent on cricket. Most importantly, though, the average Indian cricket fan accepts being mistreated when they go to the game. And that is what we're going to talk about, Deep. The fans are where the Indian cricket power really comes from, because there's a billion of them. This is where broadcasting cricket in India is so powerful. This is why Star is paying 16,000 crores for the IPL. They're paying 7,000 crores for the India rights. Why Indian cricket controls world cricket? Why BCCI controls world cricket? Because they have this billion power. Why are they mistreated?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I mean, we are who we are, and cricket is what it is in our country, which is a lot of people say, and I agree, is as good as a religion, is because of the billion plus fans. I mean, listen, me, I started off playing cricket because I was a fan. I started playing cricket because 83 India won the World Cup, and things changed around me. Everyone was talking about cricket. The only sport that was being played was cricket. So I think, I mean, it is very, very important to understand and respect what a fan means to the sport. And it's not just about cricket. I mean, look at any successful sport. It is the fan who runs the sport.
Right. So in this conversation, first of all, I want to outline my experience at Pune. And I'll tell you why I'm doing that. Because I was going to the Pune stadium. It's 25 kilometers away from the city. So I got a cab. There were three checkpoints. There were three police checkpoints. Two of them did not allow me to go through. I had to argue with them to allow me to go through. Then I got to the third checkpoint where I was asked to get off the car, which is obvious because it was close to the stadium. Then I had to walk to gate number one. That's 1 kilometer away. I tried to get in. They won't allow me in because I have a laptop back and I have a media pass. They said, so what? Then I go to gate number 2, 3, 4, again denied entry. Finally to gate number 5, because I had a media pass, I walked through. But then you're talking about the average fan who has to park his car at the first checkpoint, which is walking at least 5 kilometers away from the ground. Our initiative here at Hotspot is always to engage with the cricket fans, and that's why we are highlighting this plight of the Indian cricket fan, and we want to invite them here to talk about their experiences. And of course, we are inviting the first fan here, Vineet Gharge from Mumbai. He's joining us late in the night. Welcome, Vineet. How are you?
Thank you so much, Chetan. I'm doing good.
Well, Vineet is, a part of the famous North Stand gang, which have their origin at the Wankhede Stadium, the grand Wankhede Stadium. If you've heard of the Bami Army and the Swami Army or the Bharat Army, you have to have heard of the North Stand gang. They're really loud, just love them. Again, welcome to the show, Vineet. Tell us about yourself a little bit, very briefly, and how you joined the North Stand gang.
So, Chetan, I'm an engineer. I work in Mumbai. I was fascinated by the North Stand gang. I used to see their tweets, the way they cheered for the Indian team.
Yes.
And that is what drove me towards the North Stand gang.
And when was your first experience of going to the Wankhede and cheering with them and, you know, becoming a part? From what I understand, all you need to do is go and cheer with them and you're part of the North Stand gang, really.
My first experience of cheering for the Indian team with the North Stand gang was during the New Zealand ODI in 2017 at the Wankhede. And
right.
It was a terrific experience.
But India lost that match, didn't they?
Yeah, the result did not go quite our way, but the atmosphere that the North Stand gang created was terrific.
I remember the 2016 England Test match. I remember the entire Indian team, because the North Stand gang was situated to the right of the press box. And they took a round of the entire ground. But specifically, Virat loved the North Stand gang. He came, he cheered for the North Stand gang. The entire team clapped.
Yeah, I was in another stand. I was not with the North Stand gang at that time.
Well, now you're a part of the North Stand gang. Tell us, Deep, have you ever experienced the North Stand gang in as a broadcaster during the IPL or with Sony or with Star?
No, the only problem is in Wankhede, the commentary box is the other side, right? It's the other end.
Okay.
But I have encountered them in a Ranji Trophy because they are there during Ranji Trophy as well. They're very vocal. And it's great, you know, it's great to see the passion that they have for not just Indian cricket, because obviously everyone is a fan of Indian cricket, but, you know, the passion for Mumbai cricket. I mean, that is important, I mean, first class cricket is the main thing. I mean, everyone is a fan. Everyone who lives in the country would say, yeah, I'm a cricket fan. But the true and real fans are fans who follow their own first class teams. And that's where I think they are special.
Well, they are special in more ways than one, because I was looking at the Twitter conversation. They were really upset when the home schedule was announced. I was at the World Cup and they were throwing so many questions at me on Twitter. Chetan, why there's no match in Bombay? And I was like, listen, calm down, guys. You can't get a test match every year. There's a home season next year. England are coming in 21. Australia are coming. You will get your matches. There are T20 and ODI matches, but let's get straight to the point here. I mean, these guys, because there was no test match in Wankhede this year, they went to Pune, right, Vineet? Tell us a little bit about your experience. Like I said, it was bloody hard to get in. It's almost like they're doing us a favor by allowing us into the stadium, wasn't it?
Absolutely correct, Chetan. The Pune Stadium itself is a beautiful and picturesque one, but the location, it's more than almost 25 to 30 kilometers away from the city center, right on the expressway. So accessibility to the stadium is a major concern. Yes. And unless one has a private vehicle or a two-wheeler, you won't be able to reach the stadium. There's absolutely no public transport.
Absolutely. Mm. And there was a time, you know, when the Jamtha Stadium in Nagpur used to be the least accessible stadium. But today, that highway has developed a lot. You're looking at Rajkot, the stadium is outside the city. Yeah. That highway is also very active. You look at Visakhapatnam, again outside the city, the highway is very active. This highway, not really that active in terms of the vehicles stopping or not stopping. But more than that, more than the accessibility, there were also problems with food and water. I am told there was no good food available. I am told water bottles were not allowed inside. They were not allowed inside the stands even, Vineet. Is that true?
Yes, Chetan, it's absolutely true. Water bottles are not allowed inside the stadium. The local association had provided free drinking water, but the condition in which it was provided was slightly unhygienic. Like, there were steel glasses which were continuously falling down in the dustbin below.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Also, there were no counters to buy bottled water in case one wants to buy them. As the test match went on to day 3 and day 4, which were the weekend days, the stock of water ran out by lunch. And it was the senior citizens and the kids who were the most affected, because in the post-lunch session, water was not available for quite a long time.
As a cricketer, as an ex-cricketer, a commentator, a selector, somebody who's had a major stake, does it not break your heart that Indian cricket fans are treated this way?
It does. I mean, my point is they're not asking for a lot, right?
Yes.
The basics like water, food, washrooms. You know, yes. I mean, listen, we're talking, all three of us are guys. They're ladies' washrooms. You'll very rarely come across a ladies' washroom.
Yes.
You know, if there are seven men's, you'll find two ladies' washrooms. I mean, listen, the whole idea is to encourage families to come in, encourage women to come in. That's where the kids will come in. See, we guys, we can go with friends and all. The kids, the next generation will only come in when you get the mothers in, you're going to get the sisters in. Yes. So I think it's very, very important to encourage families. Maybe, I mean, make it like a picnic, a day out. You know, you're going to watch a movie rather than going to watch a movie. You know, come watch a game of cricket. I can understand why most of the stadiums are outside the city and accessibility is an issue, because we're talking about huge parcels of land. You know, Wankhede again is an old stadium, hence it in right in the middle of town, as we call it, Mumbai town. Same with Eden Gardens, but all the new stadiums, the Jamta you mentioned, the Motera, even this Pune, the new stadiums are outside the city, which I can understand. But then I think it's the responsibility of the local association to make sure there are buses available or public transport available, and you can drop off and drop on, and you know, you can have, you know, park and drive kind of a thing that we have outside the country. You park your car somewhere and there are buses plying to the ground and back from the ground. So I think there are things that can be done. Water is a massive issue. Yes, I can understand, because it all started, to be very honest, from the crowds itself, right? Remember bottles being thrown inside the ground and all. That was the reason why bottles are still not allowed. But I think, you know, then you have to find a way out of this. I can understand the reasons behind whatever's been happening, but obviously that's not ideal, right? And that's something. And now, I mean, because cricket is more and more becoming TV viewer friendly, right? Not really live. A lot of people really would rather sit in the comfort of their homes and watch it on television.
Which is I'm sorry to butt in here, which is a very, very important point, Adeep, because we need to tell us this thing. Because of the facilities that are not being provided to fans at the game, would you rather sit at home and watch the game? I know you love the game. You've traveled all the way from Mumbai and watched the game at Pune. And you know, we really appreciate that. But would you, having experienced this, would you rather sit at home and watch the game?
Absolutely, Chetan. Looking at the facilities, sometimes thoughts like watching it from home crosses our minds. But it's the passion which drives us to the stadium. And we're sure if the facilities are improved, more and more people would want to come to the stadium to watch more games.
Deep, you know, you talked about the transportation bit. There's a ground at Southampton, the Rose Bowl or the AGS Bowl. Yeah. I don't know what they call it. But it's outside the city. And there are people, because it's very close to London, people are coming in, day trips from London to watch the game. I live in London. When there's a test match in Southampton, I take the train every morning and come back. They have buses from the city. They have buses from the Southampton Airport Station, which is midway between the stadium and the city. And they have buses in the morning, buses in the evening, to meet every train, to meet the requirements of the people. Yes. If they can do it, why can't it be done in India?
Because I tell you why. Because predominantly it's like a lot of different departments coming together and organizing, right? You have the association, but then for something like a public transport, it's not the association, right? So association has to go to the local municipal corporation or government or whatever it is to kind of help the association out. And now, again, that boils down to whether the authorities are in the right mood, where they want to do it, don't want to do it. So I think there are, you know, that's where I honestly believe, you know, maybe, just maybe, BCCI should have a separate department to look after the fans.
Yes.
You know, like how BCCI has done so well in terms of social media, with their interaction with fans and, you know, putting things up on social media off the field and all that. I think maybe just have a different vertical where they just look after the fans. Yes. Even there's a lot of fans who want to travel. For example, India's going to New Zealand. There would be some people who would want to travel.
Yeah.
Cricket Australia, they have their own travel desk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, things like that for the fans, if BCCI can, I mean, I would really, really hope and urge BCCI to have a group of people who just look after fans and how convenient it could be watching the game and following the game could be for the fans.
Well, just the last point, because we're starting to run out of time on the show. Because of so many issues, Deep and Vineet, this is a question that I'm throwing out to both of you. should Test cricket be held only at your conventional stadiums, which are easier to get to? You have Mumbai, you have Indore, you have Bangalore, you have Chennai, you have Delhi, Calcutta. These are stadiums which are inside the city, easier to get to. Obviously, it does not take away from the fact that fans at Mumbai, Delhi, Kolkata, all these stadiums need to be treated better as well. Does not take away. You need to provide water. You need to provide shade. Mohali is in the middle of the city. There is no shade. Even Eden Gardens, not all stands have shade.
Yeah.
Delhi,
yeah,
the top tier doesn't have shade. So you're talking about basic food, basic water, and shade from the weather. Is this a huge factor? Should grounds, at least when you talk about accessibility, should Test cricket be held in city, in the in your conventional stadiums, in your regular stadiums, your traditional centers? Vineet, first of all, what do you think? And listen, you cannot be biased because Wankhede did not get a Test match this time. Okay.
Absolutely, Chetan. We all believe that Test matches should be held at the conventional venues, which are Mumbai, Chennai, Bangalore, Kolkata, and Delhi, because, for example, the Wankhede Stadium in Mumbai, it's a stone's throw away from the Churchgate railway station. Hence, connectivity is excellent. Getting to the ground is very easier by means of public transport. All Test matches should be held at conventional venues like Mumbai.
And of course, it helps, you know, and perhaps Vineet, does it help that, you know, if you don't get something good to eat or drink, you can just eat a bit, maybe for half an hour, and come back again to watch the match? Does it happen like that? Does it work like that?
Absolutely. In Pune, re-entry was not allowed, while in Mumbai, re-entry is allowed. There are various options just outside the stadium. You can just walk out at lunch, have something to eat, and get back into the stadium for the post-lunch session.
Deep, finally, right, what do you say very quickly?
Right, I'm gonna take a different take on this. I've got a different take on this, and this is what I think. There are various factors which should be kept in mind. One of them, yes, what you guys been talking about. Yeah. But the important factor is, listen, if it's in Mumbai, right, from 9 a.m. in the morning, 9:30 a.m. in the morning to 4:30 on a Thursday, I'm not too sure how many people would come and watch it, right? And also the fact that, you know, conventional venues like Calcutta, Mumbai, Delhi, they have an overdose of cricket, and they have IPL, they have T20 one day. So they have at least 8-10 cricketing days, you know what I'm saying? Yes. I honestly believe Test matches should be taken to unconventional venues like Ranchi, where there are like cricket-starved crowd there. Yeah. There's a very, very few days of live cricket that they can watch. Yeah. I think Test matches should be taken to those venues. Like Indore is a good example. Wonderful stadium, wonderful infrastructure. The whole stadium is predominantly shaded. And obviously, they don't get a lot of live cricket. I think venues like Indore would do very well. Venues like Ranchi will do very well. And I think Test matches should be played in venues like these. Combination of a few things, not just the facilities, but also how much live cricket do they get otherwise.
The one point I have always thought about is maybe say somebody like, you know, Calcutta, Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, let them have the Tests and the IPL. Let's take the ODIs and T20s to the non-conventional centers, tier 2 centers. Let's give them regular ODI and T20 cricket and maybe grow it that way. But most importantly, whether you are in Pune, whether in Guwahati, whether in Kolkata, Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, Chennai, wherever Indian cricket fans are, there is no doubt that they need to be treated better. Vineet, you're a very special guest here for us. Can you entertain or can you regale us with one chant from the North Stand?
Yeah.
I know it's 11:35 in the night, but I'm sure Indian cricket passion burns really well in you. Just one little chant for us from the Pune Test match, at least.
Go for it, Vineet.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with the chant, which is the favorite one for all of us, which is India ka king kaun, Sachin, Sachin. Mumbai ka king kaun, Sachin, Sachin. Sachin,
absolutely.
Sachin.
Sachin, Sachin. Did you ever do Sachin, Sachin?
Yeah, yeah. Every day. I mean, come on. Who wouldn't do that? Who wouldn't do that?
We're all Indian cricket fans. We've all, at some point or the other in our lives, have gone Sachin, Sachin. Right, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thanks a lot, you know, for listening. We will be back next week, of course, after the third test in Ranchi, to take a look back at India and South Africa again. Thanks to Vineet and the North Stand gang for being there in Pune and being with us here, as also the billions of Indian cricket fans. Hopefully, they'll be treated better going ahead. In the meantime, do leave your feedback and comments. Share it on social media. Reach out to us on social media as well. We are now on Apple iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn, and you can subscribe to this podcast hotspot there as well. Until next week, it's goodbye from all of us.
Dhoni finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.